Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Since the election of President Donald Trump in 2016, women have been more politically vocal and politically active. In fact, an Iowa State University Center for Women and Politics says more Iowa women are running for office and winning. Diane Bystrom is the director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics. Bystrom says women have felt the need to get involved after the loss of the first female presidential nominee. Was it the election of 2016? A lot of people have said that election really spurred women to take action.
Yes, I think so. We saw that the day after the election. We have a ready-to-run campaign school that we hold every other year in odd number years. So we had a campaign school in 2017. And so we were planning to do our start our publicity on that campaign school the week after the November 2016 election. But the day after the election, we started getting sort of unsolicited emails to our Catt Center main address from people wanting to know when our next campaign school was. And then the next 3 days, we got nearly 50, again, unsolicited emails asking about Ready to Run Iowa. And so we had a record enrollment this year. We had to move it off campus. We had 172 different participants come to at least one, up to six different workshops held on three Fridays. And the 2015 workshop, which was our largest enrollment before 2017, had 71 different individuals. And so we more than doubled our participation in Ready to Run. So we knew that something was going on. And so we knew that there was a lot of excitement and engagement for women running for office. And many of them told us that they were inspired to run really after they got up, from the election. There was some disappointment that Hillary Clinton wasn't elected, but others voiced the fact that they just felt they needed to do something. And so we saw our first kind of surge of women running for local races, and now we're seeing women running for state races and also national races.
So do you know how many women are actually beginning to run in local elections around Iowa?
On local elections, we're the only ones in the state actually collecting gender information, so it's a pretty time-intensive task. So right now, we're in the process of updating our reports on mayors in Iowa, members of city council. Our school board data is fairly recent, and we've actually just seen over the last few years in these collection cycles that women's representation on school boards, as mayors, and in city councils have only gone up a little bit in each cycle that we have collected information. So we're really interested to see what the impact will be in 2017, where we did see a lot of women running for school board and city council, and in many cases, we know anecdotally that they flipped male majority boards into female majority boards, and so we do know that, and we do know that there's a record number of women running nationally in 2018, so we're still kind of trying to get, at the bottom of it statistics-wise, but we are expecting to see some greater gains in 2017 and 2018 in women's representation, not only at the local and state level, but also at the national level.
It is interesting if you look around at county boards, city councils, even the school board, especially here in Northwest Iowa. I have not seen very many female candidates in those elections in the last few years. And I thought it was interesting what you said. Women have to be asked three times to run.
Yes, and some research even says they have to be asked seven times. And so the very first thing that we do with Ready to Run is that we ask women to run. And we ask them to run at least three times in a presentation I do, and sometimes it's even more than that. So, most women need to be encouraged to run for office. What we are seeing in 2016 is that, many women encourage themselves, and they did kind of the same thing that men do, is that they get up the next day and say, I can do this. There's also Republican women that have shared with us, and our Ready to Run campaign school is nonpartisan, that they actually got up and thought, Donald Trump had a very unconventional, he wasn't a politician, he was a businessman. So that, in fact, inspired some Republican women to think, I can run having not, run for office before. And so, it's also had, I think, an impact among Republican women. But, I think you've seen in your part of the state is that you had a woman candidate just recently in a special election. There's a woman from your area who's primarying Steve King. And so I think there are some things that you're seeing in your area. But certainly, we've seen We do know that 11 of our Ready to Run 2017 participants won their races for either school board or city council. And those are not only in the metropolitan areas where we did see women running in Waukee that attended Ready to Run, Urbandale, Ames, but also we've seen people in Bettendorf, Dubuque, some cities out east. One woman wrote us to tell us that she was the first woman, or she's the only woman on serving on the city council. And so, you know, we have seen some gains in other areas of the states where women haven't been elected before.
Women have these mom skills that sometimes they discount, and mom skills cover just about everything because you have to be able to do many things at once, and you have all these stakeholders in your home and outside. And so women are actually, they know a lot more than they think.
Certainly that's something that has been, I think, something that women have been saying in running for office. And we actually saw sort of an uptick in that in 2014, where many women running for Congress, including Joni Ernst, talked a lot about the skills that they had as a mother. And so there's been some recent research that has come out of a foundation that studies women running for office that has found that when they did sort of these focus groups and showed these ads about how women should handle motherhood, because in the past it's been seen as if you're a mother, and especially if you have small children, there's some survey research that shows that some people may not vote for you worrying that you have too much to do at home. So this recent study showed, that I think was conducted around 2016, right around the election time, really showed that women running for office can actually bank on those skills and talk about how those skills prepare them for elected office. So that's something that has been more recent, and I've seen a lot more women use those skills in not only running for state office, but also state and federal office.
Do you think it makes a difference, especially to young girls, to see their mother, other women in their lives running for office and getting into office and really, you know, learning and becoming part of that?
No, I think so. And that's the article did talk a lot about political ambition. And that's the biggest thing right now. The difference between men and women getting elected to office is just so fewer women actually run. And it's because they have less political ambition. And so what that shows is that right now, the surveys show us, or survey research shows us, is that young women aren't as encouraged to go into politics when they are in middle school or high school as young men are. So certainly, I think these young children, boys and girls, seeing their moms run for office, certainly that will have an effect, I think, on, breaking down kind of those barriers and those stereotypes, but also sort of a role model effect. And that's actually what we need to be doing, is, encouraging young women to run for office. And again, that's not coming as much from their parents or their school teachers or their coaches. And so, that's something I think that they need to be encouraged more to do.
Has women's role in politics really changed over the last 20 years or so?
It's going to be interesting. I actually started doing research on women in politics back in 1990, and certainly have lived through what we still call the Year of the Woman Candidate, and that was in 1992, where a record number of women ran that year and were elected to office. And the percentage growth is still the greatest percentage growth that we've seen over the past, 35 years. And so what some scholars are thinking, will this be our second year of the woman? It's come quite a long later, but certainly there seems to be a lot of interest and enthusiasm in women running for office and really feeling more confident in the skills that they bring to elected office.
Have you seen more women at your Ready to Run training conference?
We had women, not only Democrats, but Republicans, come to Ready to Run this year, and we're inspired to run for a local office. And so I think we're seeing a wave across the state of women running and women being more confident, again, in the skills that they bring to government. And, part of that is, a lot of women, instead of being turned off by the partisan nature of politics today, want to help fix it. And, even if you're on a different side of a political issue, if you're male or female, you typically don't seem to be as rancorous as you tend to be sometimes with men debating an issue. And so, even when women disagree about an issue, they're able to engage civilly and politely in their disagreements, which I think, a lot of voters want to see right now. And I think that's the other thing that I really haven't mentioned, is I think we've also seen some interest among voters, not just women voters, but men voters, in voting for people who are different. And that means voting for younger people, voting for women, and voting for people of color.
That was Diane Bystrom, the director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University in Ames. The center is documenting more women in Iowa and across the country who've been running for local, county, and national offices since the 2016 election. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa State University Extension Service is spearheading the effort to hear the stories of the land-grant legacy farms in Iowa. Those farms were sold after the Morrill Act of 1862 to provide funding for the building of Iowa State University. John Lawrence is the Iowa State University Interim Vice President for Extension and Research. Lawrence visited Northwest Iowa this week and explained the Legacy Farm Program and how the land-grant system worked.
The concept of land-grant university is quite literal. The federal government gave land, granted land, to the states to develop colleges. So let's back up a little step before that, right? 1803, the United States bought the Louisiana Purchase and had all of this land. They wanted to get it into private hands that would make it productive, pay taxes, those types of things. So in our educational system was based at that time largely on kind of the European model that was the aristocrats. Only the wealthy could afford college. And so this was really a noble experiment about how to make education accessible and affordable. And they talked about, education for the sons and daughters of farmers and mechanics. And so the Morrill Act was what was signed by Abraham Lincoln, I think it was 1863. Iowa was the first state in the nation to accept the terms of the Morrill Act. And by accepting those terms, the federal government gave parcels of land to the state of Iowa that could either be rented or sold to generate dollars to create this college for the public. And so that's the land grant behind it. Other states, interestingly, if you think about it, east of the Mississippi was largely settled. So where did Virginia get their land grant? Where did Massachusetts? Oftentimes it was Iowa land that was given to those states to be sold to fund land-grant universities in their states. We found evidence of 25 states that were given land in Iowa, because it was still owned by the federal government, to develop their own land grants.
So that's fascinating, because we tend to think it's within our state, and that's how each state does this on their own.
Exactly. And oftentimes people think, and I did at one time, think it was a land where the campus sits today, but it really wasn't. It was land the federal government still owned, and if you think about that time period, the 1860s, Northwest Iowa was not yet settled. So the land that we found that was given to the state of Iowa was across about 23 counties in Northwest Iowa, because eastern part of the state, the southern part, had already been homesteaded or bought and owned privately, so the federal government couldn't give it to anybody.
When you look at the map of these lands, so many red dots right up here in Northwest Iowa, and further up you go, sort of a little east of the Great Lakes, a whole lot of them right there.
Yeah, Kossuth County, of course, it's a large county. It's kind of a double in size, but a lot of land in Kossuth. Palo Alto, Emmett had a lot of land at that time that wasn't yet claimed, that was given to our land surveyor. Went and identified to say, yep, that's the parcel we want. So there's about 1,200 individual parcels that a person representing the state of Iowa identified. It wasn't just, well, you go take that or we'll sign it to you. He went and handpicked these to say, these are the ones that we want. Now, the same time was going on, and I'm not a great historian here, but the railroad was given a land grant, right, to build the railroad. But oftentimes that was land on either side of the track that they were lying. So they had to avoid those, but then find these that had not yet been claimed.
Was there a price set for these per acre?
No. So again, the Iowa was given this land, and they gave to all states basically 30,000 acres per elected official. So at that time we had two senators and six congressmen, so we had eight. times 30,000 is 240,000 acres that the state was given. Now, what we did with it, once we laid claim, got the legal title and everything, our land manager began renting it initially to farmers, and then eventually began selling it and sold it over something like a 20-year period. You didn't want to flood the market, put it all for sale at once because the price had collapsed. You'd been working with these farmers over the years. If they weren't ready to buy, you didn't want to sell it out from under them. So it was carefully and strategically managed. We rented for a while, and then we began selling parcels of it.
It was something where you're saying maybe they were renting, they could rent it, and then they could buy it?
Yeah, it was eventually sold. And I don't know the exact terms, but my sense is that many of the people who were renting it probably were interested in buying it. If you go to our webpage, you can scroll over one of those red dots, and it will pull up who the first buyer of that land was and what the date and a legal description of the land and what it sold for. And oftentimes it was in the $4 to $8 an acre range when a private person bought it from the state, and then those dollars were dedicated to Iowa State College at that time.
This is a different situation, say, than homesteaders out in the Dakotas and Nebraska.
Yeah. So again, homesteads are another example of a land grant, if you will. You were given land, but the terms were you had to live on it for 5 years, you had to farm it and do those types of things. But it's about that same period of time, right? The Transcontinental Railroad Act, the Homestead Act, the Morrill Act were all things signed by Abraham Lincoln that really set in place not only Western expansion of the United States, but build the capacity, right? Developing a college to have educated people or better access to educate people as they moved into these regions.
And you've been trying to get in contact with some of these landowners today. You talk about legacy farms, and how would you define a legacy farm?
Well, this is just we're defining as just the people who own that land now. Are they aware that their land was part of this grant to help establish Iowa State College, Iowa State University? Some of the current owners bought it recently. We talked to one family that bought it in the 80s. We bought one that I think here in Woodbury County bought it in the 30s during the Depression or shortly thereafter. So they weren't the original. But we have found some of the families who were the first, or their ancestors were the first buyers from the state of Iowa. I think folks Maxwells that you're going to talk to from Moville, I've not met them personally, but the story I heard is they weren't aware of it. When they got to looking at their abstract, it quoted the Morrill Act right on the front of their abstract.
And you want to know more about these families. You've got a website set up. How does that work?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things we'd like to do. One is we'd like to have you go in and say, all right, yeah, I'm one of those owners. That, you know, we had people and we've talked to them and they'll come up to us at a meeting or a trade show and they'll say, that looks like my farm or my dad's farm. And so we can scroll on it and get the legal description. We'd like to have them verify that. So can they like take a picture with their phone and text it or email it to us, the legal description, so we can match it up, because we want to confirm that those are the right parcels. So that's one piece. The second piece is we'd like to hear your story. We often talk to people that you know, remember growing up on that farm and having, you know, blizzards and or playing in the haymow, or grandpa talking about when his dad first come to this and bought the land. We would like to hear those stories. And so that's a place where you can either contact us or just simply write your story. And then when other people visit that website and they click on a particular parcel of land or they click on that website, they can see and read those stories as well.
You can learn so much about the people who've lived there and what they went through, especially families that have gone through the Depression on these lands and how they've changed over the years.
Well, exactly. And land, we talk about legacy. It's not just Iowa State's land grant legacy. It's the legacy of that family with that land. Land and farms are very personal to people. Some, you know, whether you grew up there, your character was shaped there, your ancestors made it what it is today. People get very emotional about the land. And we have many of these people that have gone on to Iowa State that I feel very proud and connected there. This is that opportunity to say, you know, that there was that tie back in your life. You may not have known it, but the land that you're farming now, the land that you grew up on, has a special place that helped make Iowa State possible.
Do you think the Extension Service, it really is something that reaches out to people and connects them not only with the land, but with Iowa State, other people that have gone to Iowa State? It seems like an all kind of encompassing thing.
Yeah, certainly as we talk about Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, and again, that is part of the land grant. We talk about the three-legged stool, right? Teaching, research, and extension. And if we go back to our Morrill Act, it was to teach the sons and daughters of farmers and mechanics. Well, what are we going to teach them? We need new discoveries, so we established the research experiment stations with the Hatch Act in the late 1800s. And then we've got all this research and knowledge. How do we get it out to the people that need it? We had the Extension Service. And Northwest Iowa was critical in role in the extension because we talked about the seed corn trains. We would send a professor on a train to Northwest Iowa to talk, and that was 1903. It was really kind of credited with being the first extension program in the nation. By 1905, we were sending train loads of professors to towns like whether it be a Red Oak or a Sheldon or wherever that would have a week-long short course. And then by 1906, I think the state set up a fund to help partially fund local extension if the local counties would put money in. And then around 1912, I think we had some of the first counties raise enough money to establish and hire a local county agent that was tied directly to campus. Woodbury County celebrated their centennial last summer as 100 years. We've got 51 counties this year in 2018 that formed their Extension Service 100 years ago. But we talk about a 99-county campus. There's actually 100 extension districts. Pottawatomie County has two. And it's, again, the unique part of the land grant is that we take the resources from the university and make them accessible out across the state, much like the original Morrill Act talked about accessibility to education.
So you would like families out there to get in touch with you?
Yes, absolutely, for a whole variety of reasons. One, around the land grant legacy, go check out our website and see if they own land or their parents own land or whatever. Is it one of these parcels? And tell us your story. But more importantly, I think, as you think about, you have questions about whether it's farming or parenting or 4-H or communities, we work in all of those areas. And we bring research-based information and education to help people make better decisions. We're not trying to sell anything. We're trying to help people better their lives. We want a strong Iowa.
That was John Lawrence, Iowa State University Interim Vice President for Extension and Research. He and other Extension Service personnel are seeking owners of land-grant legacy farms to tell their stories. Most of the land-grant farms are right here in Northwest Iowa. One of them was recently featured in Iowa State's Visions Alumni magazine. The Maxwell family owns a farm. They live now in Mowville. Helen and Don Maxwell met at Iowa State. Helen graduated with her degree in child development in 1949, and Don got his veterinary medicine degree in 1951. Both of them were in the Greek system. They have been proud alumni ever since, and their children and grandchildren have attended ISU. They were even named ISU Parents of the Year in 1977. Now retired, the Maxwells were thrilled to find out that they were the owners of a legacy land-grant farm. Helen Maxwell's father bought the farm in the 1930s.
The original people that got it, Rawsons, and Rawsons were great people in our community. They were farmers. And then there were another few people that bought it. But I imagine Rawson's had it for a long, long time because there's still Rawson's in that vicinity. But my dad was a banker, and sometimes when good land would come up, boy, he always he always stated that he made more in the farms than he made in the bank. And he was interested in it, and he was interested in cattle, feeding cattle, so he helped a lot of people.
Helen meant to spend some time at a college in Denver before coming to Iowa State. She went out there to alleviate her persistent allergies, but she wasn't there long.
Then my brother came, and he was in the service, and he came back to Iowa State. And my brother said, I was just going to go out there 2 years. My brother said, if you're going to go to Iowa State, you better start at Iowa State. And so that's why I did. And I'm really glad.
Helen said attending Iowa State right after the Second World War definitely had its social advantages.
When I went down to college, it was the war had just been over, and the campus was 8 or 9 men to every woman. And I said it was just very desirable because she had dates 6 weeks ahead of time. I mean, the potential, the fellas all came back, and there just wasn't that many gals.
When the story of the family farm was published in the Vision magazine, Helen says several of her sorority sisters got in touch with her.
Oh, we have one from Savannah, Georgia, that called me right up when she got the Vision magazine, and one from Connecticut. Called up. I mean, she's in a home because her husband died. But she, when the Visions magazine, and then I, actually, what was really, I was thrilled about, is my teacher for us in child development. The teacher wrote me a note, and she's 93. She wrote me a note, and she's got her memory, and her husband was a veterinarian, but he had died in 2005, I guess. But I was really pleased. Her name is Martha Gamble, and I remember, she was a very good child development instructor.
Extension service riders and a photographer took the whole family out to the now rented farm back in August to talk about the history of the farm and take a lot of pictures.
We had to go out, and I just thought we'd load it up. No, we're going out. And I think that, what's his name? I should know. Jim, I think he took 600 pictures, but he takes them fast.
Helen and Don Maxwell still live in downtown Mobile. They have a house full of happy memories of Iowa State, including cyclone blankets and a set of salt and pepper shakers made to look like ISU football players. They were happy to have a chance to find out more about their farm and to share some stories about their time at ISU. The Legacy Land Grant Project continues. If you have a land grant farm and want to get involved, go to landgrant.iowastate.edu.
And here's a little tribute to Iowa State and the football team from the 816 Boys and the Iowa State Drum Corps.
This is a cyclone weather alert. Ladies and gentlemen, radar has indicated a strong storm approaching Jack Rice Stadium. High winds and low visibility are expected. Fans in the warned area should seek immediate cover.
Cyclones, opposition's mind's blown. Turn the stadium lights on and fans know the fight's on. Throw me the bootleg and I'm gone. Then I take a few steps and I juke left, and the people take a deep breath and I'm up in your end zone. 816 boys, we reppin' connected with Iowa State. Play out of position and it's checkmate if you hesitate. You've been told offense and defense is dropping a load on all contenders that pretend to be cardinal and gold.
Your players get near. Holler if you hear.
Oh, there I go. Look out.
We're real loud. The ISU crowd going wild.
Coming through.
Calibate. Fourth and one.
run first and four, we running up the score. Even if we ain't invited, beating down your door. It's ludicrous the way we move the sticks and prove that we the ones that you should boo and hiss at. We'll lay you on your business.
Okay.
That's three and out. We the type of players y'all read about. They can never see us in the people now. The playbook W is what you need without.
Okay.
816-515, see we get live. Cyclone fans is driving out. All in the stands and they talking back.
Oh, here I go.
If you let your players get near me, holler if you hear me.
Oh, there I go.
Look out. We're real loud. The ISU crowd going wild.
Coming through.
Cook your own black gold.
Once we tap, we all in. Harden on the goal with Paul Rose. When that cannon sounds and we take the field, we in brawl mode. Cyclone power, we will devour. We loyal sons and forever true. Upset the rest, so we deserve the SB.
You agree?
Your best scream, I ask you.
S-U.
United is all for one, one for all, cause you know that we all in.
Divided
is what they find, and when the cyclones blow like a whirlwind.
Cheerleader,
check, pom-pom,
check.
Hit like a rookie,
nah.
Hit like a vet,
yeah.
Ain't no roof at Jack Trice, we too loud and we ain't done yet.
Oh, here I go.
Let your players get near me. Holler if you hear me.
Oh, there I go.
Look out.
We're real loud. The ISU crowd going wild.
Coming through.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, Iowa does have a long tradition of passing down farmland through the generations. However, inheriting a farm can be a tricky business at best. That's why the University of Nebraska-Lincoln has been holding seminars for people who've been bequeathed a farm but aren't sure what to do next. Alan Vanilek is an extension educator at UNL, and he's been conducting those classes. Vanilek says people just aren't sure where to start when they have been left a farm.
I ran into a situation in the last 2 to 3 years where people in their late 40s, 50s, 60s, even up to their early 70s are having parents that are basically failing, going away, passing away, or get put in a nursing home and not able to function for themselves. And so and where people that are relatively older in their life and maybe grew up on the farm, but now 30 or 40 years later have a farm to manage because mom and dad are gone or nearly gone. And so, you know, a lady calls me up just last month and says, mom's in a nursing home. She can't answer for herself, and I'm the executor of the estate, so I have the power of attorney for her operations, so I have to manage this farm, and I haven't been on the farm for 40 years. I don't know what to do. So we were having those phone calls the last 2 or 3 years, and so we said, well, let's put together our land management education class in a way to address the issue of either you're inheriting or have inherited a farm. Now what? How do you manage it? What do you do with it? And that's where this whole thing came from. So what we do in the workshop then is we cover 4 or 5 basic things. We cover what's land worth, what do you have, and what's that look like. Jim, my coworker, talks about the land value survey. We talk about how land is owned because that may have something to do with what you can or cannot do with it. Not only the way it's owned, but also who owns it. Are you owned it by yourself? Do you own it with brothers and sisters? What does that look like? Then I talk about communication because, 90% of our people have to deal with brothers and sisters or aunts or uncles or cousins or somebody and how to deal with this land. So I talk about family communications and how if we don't have good communications, don't set up good communications, something's going to get messed up. But more importantly, I talk about, hey, before we start talking about what's going to happen with the land, let's talk about the family first. When we get done with this process, are we still going to have a family or not? That's kind of a key question. Because if you go into the process not worrying about whether you have a family or not, or worrying about that you will have a family at the end, those are two different outcomes, and it has two different changes the tone of the conversation a couple different ways. So the family has a lot to do with it, and we have the situations, all kinds of situations where we end up with people with hurt feelings because they didn't just the good solid communication just wasn't present. It just didn't work. And then we talk about if you're going to sell it, how you get an appraisal done, if you're going to keep it, well, how are you going to keep it? And maybe you're going to farm it. Probably not. You're probably going to rent it out. And what the styles of renting is, how you can rent it, and then some good lease arrangements. So what are some good lease provisions to have in place so that you have a solid successful lease.
I was somewhat surprised, although I probably shouldn't be, at the large percentage of farmland that is rented.
Yeah, so it turns out it's something over 50, just over 50%. And so in the last 10 to 15 years, especially the last 15 years, the amount of ground that's held instead of sold on is crazy. The retention on farm ground is incredible because essentially what people are looking at is an economic issue. Farm ground still returning 1.5% or 2% up to 3 or 4% for that investment each year. There's some return there, 2.5 to 4% typically. And if you're in a passbook savings account with that money or a CD with that money, obviously it's way less than that. Incredibly low interest rates. And if you're in the stock market, yeah, you can make some money, but then you can also lose some money, as in some people are this week with the stocks dropping so much. So farm ground seems to continue to return something for the investment. And so people are holding on to it. As a matter of fact, it's proven out statistics. Farm ground, kind of the 40-year average on farm ground sales is 2 to 3%, 2.5 or 3% a year of the farm ground sales. And now the last numbers I saw take that down to 1% or less, 0.7, 0.6, 0.5% of the farm ground in a particular county sells each year. So farm ground is really, really being tightly held.
Is it hard to find this kind of information about how to, you know, deal with a farm? You inherit a farm, it comes down through your family. I was reading, one of the people who had gone to your seminar said she had tried to find some information on the internet and it was hard to find.
Well, to manage the farm isn't that hard. I mean, actually kind of connecting it together with what you're going to do when you inherit it, and then it gets to be a little bit trickier. But that's why we're offering the seminars, and that's why we're offering the online things, February 19th and February 26th, 6:30 p.m. Central. And people get online and at our website, and they can register to listen in. And we're also recording those, so those will be available online afterwards, too.
That was Alan Vanilak, an extension educator at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He is teaching a series of classes on how to handle a farm inheritance. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While Siouxland Public Media celebrates its 40th anniversary this year, the station first went on the air in January of 1978. The offerings included All Things Considered and Morning Edition, but also on the schedule were a lot of classical music, NPR Recital Hall, Black Perspectives, the Big Bands, and Farm Reports. Former Siouxland Public Media General Manager Gretchen Gondek and producer of the program Opus spoke with local journalist and historian Marcia Poole about the station's beginnings. Marcia wrote an in-depth research paper about how the station came to be.
I did this for a mass communication class at graduate school, and I went as what they call non-traditional person, simply because at that point it was, there's so much to, I have some experience, there's so much to talk about. And I was very interested in this one class, KWIT. We came to Sioux City in 1978, in the summer of 1978, and so it was on the air. But I was very interested in all the news media coverage that this had, shall I say, evoked, the opposition to it, the struggle to get funding for KWIT, that many people now, you think, well, this is more than 40 years ago, because it really started, you know, in 75, 76, when Western Iowa Tech was encouraged to go forward with a plan to have a public radio station. But, you know, we forget history, and, you know, people say, well, who was that? How did this happen? And, you know, all of the work that went into it and the reason for it. And I think that has a lot to do with why we have community colleges and some very interesting perspective from Dr. Kaiser at that time that I really enjoyed talking to him. And one of the things he told me was that it was under the code of Iowa, community colleges were formed not only to train students, but also to perform community services which would upgrade the quality of life for the constituents they serve. And I think they believe that the public radio station fulfills this criteria. It would bring education. It would bring, you know, bilingual services. It would bring agricultural reporting, the humanities, you know, music that wasn't available elsewhere. But I think there also there might have been people who think, well, it's, you know, a vocational, technical, whatever we called it at the time. And this wasn't part of their mission. And as he felt very strongly, and the other board members, it was part of their and serving the public interest.
And you know what's interesting to me is that the radio station is at a two-year technical school. It's not at Briarcliff University or Morningside College, which are more in the liberal arts.
Yes. And don't you just suppose that there was just my conjecture that's how some people felt. Although the public was really behind this, and reading editorials, particularly in the Sioux City Journal, very supportive of this. Business leaders in Sioux City, very supportive of it. The Tax Research Council, however, opposed it. They said they didn't necessarily oppose public radio, but they opposed some of the funding, some of the sources of funding, in that if there was money coming from the tax levy, and they didn't feel that was proper. There was money left over from construction of the college, and that was to be used. But, oh, my gosh, you talk about trying to get the funding and the grants. And then there were, you should just have a repeater. This should just be a repeater. Well, then when you looked at at how much that would cost, plus it would take away the eligibility for funding because it wasn't a station, it was practically a wash. We had nothing over here. And Eastern Iowa did have, they had, I don't know, were there at that time three in the mid-70s? And we had nothing. So in the summer of 1975, this is when Western Iowa Tech, the board, they determined that they were, you know, that there was a need for public radio. And frankly, it from my research, Western Iowa Tech was the only institution that was really willing to go forward with this. It was a huge amount of work and for the funding. And then, of course, the beginning, as always, construction estimates, you know, after what, 2 years, everything had gone up. And but what I was always struck by, Gretchen, with the is that it did seem to have so much public support. The tax levy was first approved by Area 3 voters in 67. This is for Western Iowa Tech, again in 1972. And now they were being asked with the public radio station to vote on it again September 10th, 1976. And that levy would add 20¼ cents per $1,000 of assessed property valuation to their tax bills. And despite the opposition, the levy passed. And it was $300,000 that Western Iowa Tech used. It was the leftover. And I just want to make that clear. Nothing else was ever used from that. I also want to point out that, yes, the startup money from the different grants, different, governmental bodies, and also that leftover money from the Sioux City property taxes. Then we have a wonderful thing known as Friends of FM 90. And Betty Main was president of that. boy, they started raising funds right away. And so any shortfall, bridged that gap. And so you see, there was just a tremendous amount of local support for KWIT. FM 90. Am I saying that right? That's right. And the operating funds for this public radio station were approved by the Iowa House and Senate on May 21st, 1977. And then the meeting to open the bids to building the station, which houses studios, or the construction of the building, that was on June 6th, 1977. And the estimated cost, $540,000. And that $300,000 came from the leftover tax levy. So that was... contracts were awarded, and at the same time, the board voted to raise tuition by 10%. However, Western Iowa Tech had the lowest tuition in the state. So this was ground was broken July 1st, 1977, right here, right where we sit. So, and less than 2 weeks later, Governor Robert Ray signed an appropriation bill which included $120,000 for KWIT's first year of operation. He hadn't always been in favor of, and this is what I find so fascinating, is the fortitude of the Western Iowa Tech Board and Dr. Kaiser in keeping at it. And I think that's the... you honor their memory and honor their legacy here at KWIT and for Sioux City and the whole listening area.
There was some opposition to the station.
Yes, and it was mainly, as I say, the tax research conference. And it hung on that factor that property taxes should not be used for this, and that was strictly for technical aspects of the community college, there was also Dr. Kaiser had some thoughts about that also, but maybe some didn't feel that the community college was the place to have public radio. So he thought that there was, I don't want to say prejudice, but the tax research conference, that's what they had pushed back about, was using that. And there were meetings, there were a lot of editorials in the journal promoting it, and there was a meeting at Denison, Iowa. It's a public meeting on July 30th, 1975, and to get input for that. And Western Iowa Tech was the institution that showed up and, really was interested in this. But think of it, they have electronics department, electronics program, and it was pretty logical. Thinking about their mission, about enriching. Look at what Western Iowa Tech does now. I, as a, shall we say, a more mature listener, the lifelong learning and all of the things that, and it's always been that way. I can remember way back, in the 70s, all the cooking classes and all the different, we had a lot of fun here. And I remember doing a lot of stories here with the, I guess at that time it was called like adult education or something. We had different terminology for it. But there was never any sense that there was some line that, because it was a community college, that it couldn't go beyond that.